From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Tom Hucker, who's a member of the Montgomery County Council. We'll also talk with Adrian Jones, the new Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates. But first up, Phil Mendelson, who is chair of the D.C. Council. Council Chairman Mendelson, welcome.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Kojo.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He is a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Before we get to the district, Tom, the race for Commonwealth's attorney for Arlington County. Apparently, one of the candidates, the primary challenger to the incumbent, has accused the incumbent of refusing to prosecute police officers in cases of brutality, and that has apparently raised the ire of the police department.
Yes, this is a defense attorney, Tagani Tofti, I think is how she pronounces her name. She's running an aggressive campaign in the June 11th primary, saying that the Commonwealth Attorney for Arlington should not prosecute marijuana cases because it's unfairly racially discriminatory, that cash bail is a bad thing because it's discriminatory, that the police need tougher checks on how they police. That's the campaign that she's running. I tried several times to get a handle on how the campaign is going or any polling, but I could not find any.
She does not like the apartment that the fact that the police department apparently investigates itself. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking about different counties and their approach to police investigation, having police in other counties do it. But that's, as I said, later in the discussion. The Metro Board was supposed to meet this week, and it was widely expected that they might be disciplining their chairman, Jack Evans, the Ward 2 council member for the District of Columbia. But that meeting didn't happen, and so there was no discipline for Jack Evans. What happened?
Well, it's a lot of internal stuff inside Metro system, but the Ethics Committee apparently was meeting and either could not reach a decision or did not reach a decision, and so it's not going forward. The two meetings that were scheduled this week were canceled for any briefings for the board. Again, all internal. So you can read the tea leaves or the smoke signals. It appears that the committee's decided it's not going to do anything. So that maybe we'll have to find out more, but somebody internally at Metro can tell us. But it appears the Ethics Committee is, if not decided, appears not to have a decision that he's done anything wrong.
On to Council Chair Phil Mendelson. You are threatening to block issuing permits for construction of city government buildings as a way of pressuring the mayor to fully implement the short-term rental regulation that was passed unanimously by the council. What is at the root of this conflict?
Well, it's a conflict that could end in a second, because all that we're requiring is that a report that was promised 7 months ago be delivered to the Zoning Commission. The issue has to do with short-term rental housing, like Airbnb. The council passed legislation last fall. One of the consequences of that legislation would be that what is now a broadly illegal activity, because it's inconsistent with zoning, would be legalized, and that people could home share, and that would increase the availability of legal housing and also take some of the pressure off of apartment buildings where we're seeing illegal short-term rental housing. In order, though, for the law to change, the Zoning Commission has to act as well. The council asked the Zoning Commission. The Zoning Commission met immediately. This was last October, and asked the Office of Planning to submit a report. That's the standard procedure before a zoning case can proceed. So, and the Office of Planning, 7 months later, still has not issued the
report.
And
so what action are you threatening to withhold? There was some concern that you were going to withhold funding and that could affect schools and others.
It would just be the issuance of government permits to the government. It wouldn't affect the private sector at all. And it's, as I said, it's a threat that could be resolved in a second. That report's written. That, I mean, that I was told in January that that report would be ready by the end of January.
Do you know why the mayor doesn't want you to have it?
Because the mayor's office says that they're moving as quickly as they can to produce this
That's
report.
That's nonsense. And when the Zoning Commission last month asked for when the Office of Planning would present the report, the Office of Planning not only refused to give a date, but gave a very formulaic answer, which is, and I've talked with higher-ups in the administration, and clearly they're blocking the report being issued.
Well, you know, this is one report about Airbnb-style rentals in the city. But the larger issue is that you have said that the mayor's 2020 budget going forward is undisciplined, that she is undisciplined. It has been very harsh words. The mayor seems to, administration seems to have ginned up the whole city government on Twitter to attack various criticisms from the council about various agency spending. You've been very harsh in your terminology of talking about the mayor. She, as we all know, was quite harsh about you a couple years ago. It looks to me like there is a real, between the mayor and the council, there's a real serious breakdown politically. And secondly, Wednesday night when you had your preliminary meeting with the council members on the budget, I watched several hours of this multi-hour thing. There were personal and racial strains between the council members themselves. It looked like you were having a hard time keeping all that done. There were questions even about whether Mary Chase Ward 3 committee, Transportation Committee could raise taxes to cover things. That got to be a fight. There was a racial discussion on the soda tax, residential permit parking.
We've got calls on all of those issues already.
On the one hand, the council's fighting pretty hard with the mayor. She's publicly fighting back on social media, and the council members themselves seem to be at odds seriously with each other, particularly McDuffie and Che. What's going on? Is there, everybody drinking Trump water?
No, and I think you're reading too much into the disagreements as if they are personality conflicts. There are policy disagreements, and the fundamental policy disagreement has to do with whether we raise taxes and fees at a time when our revenues are growing. Our revenues are $2.2 billion more today than they were when Mayor Bowser first came into office, and yet she's proposing about $120 million in new taxes. They'll fall almost entirely on the commercial sector, as if taxes don't matter to the commercial sector, but we know it will affect rents for businesses and retailers.
I appreciate there are real serious issues, but we're talking at this meeting Wednesday.
So you're talking about in the 10th hour when I got a little testy with somebody?
Well, not you personally, but I'm saying when we were talking about the 1 cent increase on the soda tax, and Mr. McDuffie said that that was a lot for poor families, and African-American families he specifically, I think, mentioned, to which Mary Chase said, quoting, basically he is comfortable carrying the water for large corporations. I hear a lot of talk in this body about racial equity. Here he's staring it right in the face and he won't support it.
Well, there was a lot of rhetoric around that issue.
But then
I wouldn't read too much into
that.
I'm
reading what they said.
Let
me finish what McDuffie said. In response, he said, if Mary Chase, quote, sincerely cared about racial equity, she would sign on to his bill for racial equity. There would look to be more than just fighting in there. It looks like a real personal tension there.
I think there was only fighting in there, not more. The fact is a lot of arguments were made about the soda tax, and I believe we should not be raising taxes, including the soda tax. And on the one hand, the argument was made by some that increasing the tax will change behavior. That's a good thing because we don't want people to spend their lives just drinking soda.
And that's what Mary Chase says.
And then other people were saying, well, this will hurt, this sales taxes are regressive and this will hurt poor people more than anyone else. Folks were having it both ways with that argument, but what it really came down to was, do you support higher taxes or not? And that's really what was going on. And then secondarily, there was an argument which had come up the week before, which is whether a committee that doesn't have jurisdiction over taxes should be raising taxes.
Well, that's a big industrial issue.
Well, yeah. Speaking of the soda tax.
That's what was going on.
Here's Kathy in Washington, D.C. Kathy, you're on the air.
Good
afternoon. Go ahead, please.
No, thank you. I'm calling as the vice chair of the D.C. chapter of the Sierra Club, and we were very surprised to see the resistance to a very modest 1% increase on the soda tax. We think that that's very rational, especially in a time when you are looking to fund a lot of programs. This soda tax is, something that would help lower income families.
Would you like to know where the chairman stands on the soda tax?
Yes, and I'd like to. And he said that he doesn't support it, and I'd really like to understand why.
Go ahead, Chairman Mendels.
Well, I don't think that putting a 1 cent tax increase on soda is going to change behavior. I don't think that the current tax, which I think is 5 or 6 cents, has changed behavior.
Taxes, 7 cents would be go to 8.
Yeah, taxes rarely affect behavior other than when the taxes get high, and the soda tax isn't going to get this high, that people decide that they're actually going to move from the city. I think the behavior issue is inconsequential. I think that the government needs to live within its means. Our revenues have grown $2.2 billion in the last 4 years. Our local budget, our local funds that we raise from taxes and fees are over $8 billion a year. And what we are arguing is that we don't have enough money to do all the things we want to do. We can tighten our belt.
City Administrator Rashad Young says that the blocking of building permits would prevent school construction over the summer. Do you agree? And if so?
No, and what I said to Rashad yesterday, we met, and it was a constructive meeting, was I said, Rashad, you can release that report tomorrow and this issue goes away.
And what did he say?
I think he took it back to discuss with his colleagues.
Well, this business of school construction has a lot of people concerned, in particular about what's happening at Banneker High School. I got a letter from Natalie Hopkinson, who's been on this broadcast before, a longtime writer, scholar. She says she's an advocate of all things D.C., but she would like Banneker to be built in Shaw. She writes, I would greatly support proposals to rebuild Shaw Middle School in a different location. However, with your vote on Tuesday, you have an opportunity to do something very important in the history of the city, to create a space that can be a beacon to academic excellence for generations to come, available to any and all who come to Washington, including the residents of Shaw. And then there is this from Angela in Ward 4. Angela, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, how are you? My name is Angela, and I am a Banneker alum, both my husband and I, and my daughter is now an alum because she graduated from there last year.
What would you like to happen?
What would I like to happen? I would like Banneker to move to Shaw. I believe there are a lot of misconceptions onto why this should not occur. The main misconception is Banneker deserves to stay where it is because they believe that it has all of the resources that it needs outside of the aesthetics. And when you build from within the school where it is now, the children will not get the resources that they need. Banneker was built as a middle school, and it is constructed to hold.
And let me ask the chairman to explain what's going on and where we are. Natalie Hopkin writes, building Banneker in that high-profile location in the middle of Shaw would be a monument to black excellence because everybody knows that Banneker is the top-rated high school in the city and that its student body is predominantly black.
Just to be the other side of that is the people who live there
precisely.
Want a middle school. They were promised a middle school.
Correct.
Shaw Middle School, and they're not getting it. So this is the changing nature of the city. Where do you stand on all these educational issues?
Well, the mayor surprised everybody last August when she announced that Banneker, which has been planned to be modernized at the existing site, would move and displace, in fact, terminate the plan's longstanding promises to build a middle school where the former Shaw school is. It was a complete change after years and years and years of promises to modernize Banneker where it is and, as I said, to build a new Shaw. The fact is that Banneker is a great school, and the council has over the years, last several years, expressed impatience with the fact that the executive has put Banneker's modernization at the bottom of the list. Banneker not only should be modernized, but it can be expanded. It is below capacity right now, not by much, but it's below capacity. My understanding is that the wait list was either very small or non-existent. Yes, its enrollment should grow, but the goal of our school system should not be to double the size of Banneker when we have other high schools like Anacostia and Beaulieu that are losing enrollment. We instead should be growing the enrollment, improving the quality of all of our high schools instead of just focusing on doubling the size of one, no matter how good it is.
Okay, bottom line, you think Banneker can be improved
yes.
where it is,
yes.
and a middle school can be built in Shaw?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's what the letter I got and most of the callers we're getting are opposing. They say they don't have the resources of the Shaw community to be able to advance their position in the way that the residents of the Shaw are able to do. And this obviously has to do both with race and gentrification.
Well, but I don't think that's the issue at all. It's been a longstanding policy of the government, expressed explicit policy that Banneker would be modernized. And in fact, last year, the year before, the council said, why is Banneker at the bottom of the list for modernization? And it's a good school, and it should be moved up. So,
and that neighborhood is, in fact, in the midst of a significant gentrification. It's not an isolated factor.
What, Banneker?
Banneker,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, can we move on to the budget?
What about the Freedom of Information Act?
That's what I was going to as a part of the budget. The version you published last week includes two proposed changes to the district's Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, that some transparency advocates worry would make it harder for journalists and D.C. residents to access government emails and other documents. What exactly would these changes entail, and how do you respond to criticism that they would make the district government less transparent, less accountable?
There's a lot of sensitivity around Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA.
As well, there should be.
And the provisions in the proposal I put forth last week are, I would say, minor, and they are to clarify that what can be requested, it relates to government business, as opposed to private business, personal business. Second of all, that the request has to reasonably describe what's being requested. It can't be a fishing expedition. And I would like to emphasize, because some folks think this is only about the council, this is about all agencies of the government. And in fact, our general counsel, who brought this to me, has worked with other agencies. So just to give you an example, because I asked our general counsel this morning to give me some examples of requests, we received a request in the last year asking for information from January 1st, 2016 to the present that included a number of search terms, including the words Jew and Jewish. That's a lot of documents. It's a very general, broad, unspecific request. We received another request asking for all documents from January 1st, 2017 to the present between a particular council member's office, including staff, and DCRA. That's a lot of documents, and it's very broad. It's not asking what did Mendelsohn's office correspond with DCRA regarding 3150 Connecticut Avenue. No, it's all correspondence. And then we received another one with regarding a very prominent lobbyist. I'm not sure I want to mention his name on the air. And I just learned when I saw this today, and my staff, from 2004 to the present. So I'm hesitant to mention a name. We'll just say Tom Sherwood. Every email to or from Tom Sherwood and my office since 2004. It is, under the current law, arguable whether if my daughter sends me an email on my account, official account, which she shouldn't, regarding her doctor appointments, whether that's FOIA-able. That's correspondence on a government server, even though it's unrelated to personal business, and surely I'm not hiding anything when it's my daughter's doctor appointments.
Nothing in the law prohibits a general counsel for your counsel or for any agency to say to the person requesting additional information.
To try to narrow the request. You're right. But it's also quite possible that the person will refuse, and I believe one of these requests, the person refused to negotiate, and this is government resources on a fishing expedition.
If a person refuses,
so let's narrow it.
Well, but if you narrow it, then you leave it to bureaucrat people and agencies to decide what's too what broad, what's too this or what's too that. And when it comes to personal matters, as Peter Jameson in the Washington Post wrote, the current law says that exempted from FOI inquiries, quote, is information of a personal nature where the public disclosure thereof would constitute a clearly unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. Why doesn't that cover your daughter sending you a note to your email address?
Well, it might cover my daughter's email about her doctor appointment, but it's not so clear how much that covers regarding a constituent request. So you have you're a constituent. You have a request for me to intercede because Healthcare Finance Agency is not being responsive with your Medicaid claim with regard to your therapist. You see a psychiatrist.
That can be a healthcare issue. But here's the bottom line. Whether you can agree or disagree that you are unnecessarily narrowing it or not, the objection is that you put it at the end of a budget support act, I think that's what it's called, and why not hold a public hearing on such a, you say it's not that big of a change, but clearly every journalist that I've spoken to and community activist says it is. How about a public hearing? And several council members Wednesday night spoke right up and said they don't want this in the budget. Will you consider taking it out and have a public hearing at standalone?
Well, I recognize that I'm sitting at a table with two journalists, but it's in the interest of journalists that they have as unfettered, unrestricted access to government documents as possible. And
we also like public hearings.
And so a fishing expedition from a reporter is
But your characterization of a fishing expedition may simply be that the reporter does not want to disclose his or her real intent of doing an investigation because that will alert people to the very subject matter he or she is trying to disclose.
Well, but I think if you ask for all correspondence between me and my office and DCRA, Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, regarding Connecticut Avenue.
There is a reasonableness aspect of this law where you could A, have more staffers who deal with these things, and B, more aggressive in working with someone who's trying to get the information. You don't just have to do everything someone says in an FOI. If it's an unreasonable request, I think the law covers that.
And there's government resources tied up in redacting documents, resources tied up in negotiating with you, Tom.
Tom,
you're a pretty reasonable guy. Most of the time. But there's some requests that are, and I tried to indicate
the law allows for
very
discussion.
Broad.
So public hearing or no?
Well, there's going to be a larger bill, and there will be a public hearing on that. There's no question.
We're running out of time very quickly, but yesterday the city paper released.
Why is the clock so fast?
Because we have breaks in the show. We have breaks in the show now, and we never used to have breaks in the show before.
I thought this was not.
The city paper released their best of D.C. issue, and they chose Mayor Muriel Bowser as the best covert Republican, but Loose Lips columnist Mitch Rales mentioned you as a runner-up, saying, quote, he's an old white guy, doesn't like raising taxes, and ranks second to last among D.C. council members on the Jews United for Justice campaign fund scorecard for progressive causes. What are your thoughts on that, chat?
Well, that's not a two-minute answer. First of all, last I checked, Republicans like to cut taxes and cut taxes when there isn't the revenue to support that. And that's not where I am at all. I believe very strongly in stability with regard to what the cost is of doing business and living in the city. And to the extent that we can help people, we should do that in terms of where our tax burden is out of line. But I am not a Republican when it comes to, in fact, I'm reminded of a massive tax cut a number of years ago where my colleagues were called Republicrats by Colbert King. I was left off that list. With regard to that ranking included multiple votes on Initiative 77, and yes, there are some people who think that it was not progressive.
Now he wants to speak at length.
But the fact is that Initiative 77 hurt restaurant workers, not to prompt a whole bunch
of new calls. The
bottom
line is
workers were opposed to it.
You were opposed last year by a very progressive person, Ed Lazier, and you won re-election because you said, I am a progressive, but you're pragmatic progressive.
Phil Mendelson is a Democrat. He is chair of the D.C. Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And he's going to hold a
hearing
on the FOI Act.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with the new Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates, Adrian Jones, and later on with Tom Hucker of the Montgomery County Council. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. Joining us now in studio is Tom Hooker. He's a member of the Montgomery County Council representing District 5. Tom Hooker, welcome.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
We'll be talking with you later in the broadcast. Joining us now by phone is Adrian Jones, who is the Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates. Adrian Jones, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
First, congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Last week, we talked about exactly how this happened, despite the fact that you had dropped out of the race, that you had thrown your support to Delegate Derek Davis in his run against Delegate McIntosh, and then you got the unanimous support of everyone in the House. How surprising was all of this for you?
Very much so. It was a whirlwind day, lasting about 4 or 5 hours to the final outcome. So the main thing that we were able to bring the Democrat caucus together. So I think that Speaker Bush would be very pleased of that outcome. So,
yeah, but before you brought the Democratic caucus together, when you yourself were campaigning for this position, you crossed party lines to seek out Republican support.
That is not correct.
Right. Oh, you did not?
No, I did not.
Oh, I know Mr. Davis did that.
I can't speak for Mr. Davis, but I did not do so. And the reason why I was had to back out because I didn't have enough votes because they were, you know, splitting between two candidates, and people previously thought that I was not interested.
Madam Speaker, this is Tom Sherwood. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
You in fact wanted to be the speaker. You had been the pro tem under Michael Bush for
17 years.
Mm-hmm. You also chose, frankly, not to campaign for the job before his burial. I remember you telling the Baltimore Sun that you had a respect for him, and people had interpreted that as if you weren't really that interested in getting the job. But then there was that dramatic meeting with the caucus that met for several hours, and you were the compromise candidate. And I'm sure Speaker Bush would like that. But tell me this. What did you learn most from working so many years with Speaker Bush that will guide the way you run the General Assembly? For people who don't know, the Speaker has extraordinary power to appoint inside the House.
Yes.
What do you most learn from him? Because, you know, people are going to start complaining at some point about you, but what do you plan to do?
Well, I don't anticipate. If they really knew me, I don't know that complaints would we go. Everybody's going to have complaints. But,
right. Just the politics of the job.
The fact that the politics of the job. I'm planning to do the job as being the best as in governing and presiding over the members of the House of Delegates. I've been the last 3 weeks of the session. I was performing the job. So I did not get any complaints about my performance. I work with everyone. We have a lot of new members. And during these 9 months prior to going to the January session, I plan to be in various areas of the state, meeting with the various delegations. Because I'm a visual person and want to hear, because everyone's area of the state, they have different needs and concerns.
There are 6 standing committees. Will you have the power? Can you change the committee chairmanships away?
The chairmanship is one of the positions, one of the duties that the speaker has. I've been in the job exactly 9 days. I am not at this point ready to discuss that because we're involving different people.
But you do have the authority at any time to change the chairmanships, or do you have to do it every year or so? You can do it.
The speaker has authority to change at any time.
Madam Speaker, Republican Governor Larry Hogan has had a sometimes contentious relationship with Democrats in the General Assembly. How well do you get along with the governor, and does your reputation for consensus help you there?
Well, the governor, for the last several weeks, we have worked together in terms of our bill signing. I'm planning in the future to meet with the governor one-on-one, And, you know, we do know each other, and, you know, so we'll take it from there.
Possibly to the governor's surprise, a new poll shows that Maryland GOP voters widely favor the incumbent President Trump over Larry Hogan for the White House. The governor clearly had had some presidential ambitions. He'd been moving around, going to New Hampshire. How do you feel about whether or not Governor Hogan should run for the Republican nomination?
That's a decision he has to make. He has to make that determination.
Well, the Democratic Party was close to splitting up over whether Republicans should be included in the vote. I know Derek Davis from Prince George's County and Maggie McIntosh from Baltimore City, I think they were the two who were talking about accepting Republican votes and not just depend on the caucus. But do you think that there was continuing rifts in the party, or is that over?
No, I don't see that. The whole purpose of coming together as we did was to unite the party, and both members, if you may or may not be aware, they had, when we went to the floor, they both nominated and seconded my nomination to be the next speaker.
That's good. You went to the inauguration of the new mayor, Jack Young, of Baltimore after that terrible, what's been going on in Baltimore. What did you say there? And what, the state has a lot of authority to help Baltimore. Is there something you have in mind? You're from Baltimore County. You had thoughts of what the state maybe should do to help the city of Baltimore?
Well, for one thing, it's best to have communications with the leaders there. I plan to meet with the mayor. What I had said that, we have a new mayor that's looking in terms of what's best for the city during this time. And I think that by strengthening strengthen Baltimore City means a healthier, safer Maryland. And so we're going to be, in communication and, working together. So,
Adrienne Jones is Speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates. Madam Speaker, once again, congratulations and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, it's Tom Hooker's time. He is a member of the Montgomery County Council representing District 5. If you have questions, comments, or denunciations for Tom Hooker, you can call us at 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. Our guest is Tom Hooker. He's a member of the Montgomery County Council. If you have questions or comments for him, call us at 800-433-8850. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. Do you think Adrienne Jones is going to make a good speaker of the Maryland House of Delegates?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. No question. I had the privilege of serving under Adrienne as my speaker pro tem for the 8 years I served in the House of Delegates. Adrienne is smart as a whip. She's known for her fairness. She is very experienced. She's great at navigating disputes. And let me be kind. You know, in Annapolis, there's this adage that there's workhorses and show horses. And Adrienne is the consummate workhorse. She's the type of person that puts her head down and does the hard work behind the scenes and doesn't seek all the credit and isn't like some folks who might be checking themselves in the mirror every hour calling a press conference. She just gets the work done.
Shall see.
Why did you had eight years in the state legislature, is that right?
I did, yes.
Is that four terms?
Guilty as charged.
Why did you
quit two terms
to run for the county council?
You know,
that was in 2000, what year was that?
2014.
It seemed like ages ago, but it was just a short few.
It seems
why
like
did
a
you
lifetime
do that?
Ago.
That's a significant change to give up that much seniority in the House to be a county council member.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do it?
Well, and I served with Craig Rice, too, who came in with me in 2006 and then moved to the Montgomery County Council. I think you asked me that when I was here before. I think it's mostly because a lot of community members were concerned about the vacancy caused in our district by the resignation of Valerie Irvin at the time, my predecessor. And, our district on the east side of Montgomery, where you did a record-setting, I think, Kojo, in the community recently, has gotten short shrift on the Montgomery County budget for many years. And many people came to me and said, look, we need somebody experienced to really
get more done
to fight for us.
You organized a town hall meeting last weekend about Governor Hogan's plans to add toll lanes to the Baltimore-Washington Beltway on I-270. It drew a lot of opposition to the project, including from you, the chair of the council's Transportation Committee. Why did you organize this event, and what did you hear from residents about the highway expansion project? It seems that when we talk about it, we hear more from people who are disgruntled about it than people who are supporting it.
Oh, well, there's no question about that. And the reason I organized it really was because so many people came forward and said, look, we need an honest, authentic way to get our questions answered and air our concerns before elected officials. And I didn't really expect to be or want to be in this position, but I had attended the State Highway Administration's workshops in Silver Spring and in Rockville. In Silver Spring, 500 people turned out, and they all have questions and concerns, and they raise their hands. And these are managed by SHA as really very highly stage managed sort of dog and pony shows. They are 30-minute workshops. They spend 28 minutes going through a slide deck. They make lots of assertions like, Kodjo, you'll save 35% on your commuting time, and Tom, you'll save 40%. And, you could imagine people raise their hand and say, that sounds great. How do you know? They say, just trust us. We're not going to share our model with you or our data. You just have to trust us. We're bringing you the solution, but don't ask too many questions. And so many people were frustrated with that and asked us to organize something authentic. And on a week's notice, in the rain on a Sunday morning, nearly 1,000 people turned out. If it wasn't, on a rainy Sunday, and if we had more than a week to organize it, I'm sure thousands of people would have been there.
The Washington Post had an editorial today saying that the Montgomery County officials and in Prince George's too, who are opposing these changes in 495 and 270 in Baltimore-Washington Parkway, are engaging in folly, thinking that you can do rapid transit fixes and not do more roadways. And the Secretary of Transportation for Maryland, Pete Ron, says that you've got your, quote, heads in the sand if you think you can't do the things the governor wants to do.
Well, let me address the Washington Post first. They said in the headline, to make a dent in commute, Maryland officials need to focus on the roads. I just suggest that they should focus on the facts. They might be new to this issue, but I think they're not following.
I don't think they're new to the issue.
The question of whether we're proposing solutions. And I have the editorial, and it says that they imagine that transit alone can accommodate those million-plus new residents. I don't know any elected officials, at least, that have said transit alone is all we need. We have had a transit-first policy in Montgomery County Council, I believe all the local jurisdictions around here. We don't have a roads-only policy, and this is a roads-only plan. There were 11 alternatives put forth. The secretary scrapped the alternatives that had any transit component at all. What the screened alternatives now present are 7 alternatives that have only expansion of roads. And
you think the Post is wrong?
The Post is actually, reportedly, repeatedly, provably false in their assertions on here, because they also say we haven't put forward any solutions.
Montgomery and Prince George's, what the legislators, the county, what can you do to stop this plan going forward? And how much approval does it need for the governor to go forward?
Well,
can you do anything?
Can I just get there in a minute? I'm not sure we want to stop it. We want to modify it. We are just, it's so sad that we're in this position, because this is such a moment that we've been waiting for so many years. The Washington region needs congestion relief, as you know. And we have had so many elected officials and advocacy groups and members of the public asking for congestion relief from Annapolis for years. Finally, we have now, in the fifth year of the Hogan administration, I'm not sure why he waited so long, but in the fifth year, Governor Hogan comes forward and says, here's a maximalist all roads plan. And we've said, just work with us. There's some good ideas in here. There's some bad ideas. Go through the ordinary process and work with local elected officials and our top tier transportation experts and our planners to respect our local land use decisions and make sure that what we're doing actually relieves congestion, doesn't just enrich a private concessionaire. But so far, they've refused to work with us.
Mark Elrich, the county executive of Montgomery County, calls the governor's plan, quote, stupid, unquote. It doesn't seem that's a negotiating tactic.
Mark can defend, the county executive can defend his own quote, but I would say it's ill-conceived. The place to start for Secretary Ron would be the priorities letter that the county executive and the county council agree on every 2 years, and we send officially on our letterhead to Annapolis, and I brought them for you. So here's our 2014 letter, here's our 2015 letter, here's our 2017 letter, and they all ask for relief on 495 and 270. Specifically, they say the corridor to focus on is from Virginia all the way to Frederick. Why stop at Gaithersburg all the way to Frederick and put hot lanes or HOV lanes on the American Legion Bridge on the western portion of 495 on the spur and then all the way up 270? If you go north of Gaithersburg, you'll know folks up there go rapidly. If you're driving from here to Frederick, you go from 6 lanes each way to 2 lanes.
What do you think it will take to get the governor and his people to sit down at the negotiating table with county officials in Montgomery and Prince George's County? At this point, predisposed to do that.
Bruce DePoit wrote in Maryland Matters this week, just that last night, in a unique interview with the Secretary of Transportation, seemed not to be open to any of those ideas you just suggested.
It's very curious, and I guess I'll let you reach your own conclusions, but Secretary Ron, you know, came in, they proposed this before the reelection, and they said, look, we're going to bring all the best minds in the world together to propose solutions, but we can't tell you any details. And they got through the reelection. Then afterwards, they said, and they refused, you know, request to meet about the details. Then they met with us after the election, and we asked, you know, will you collaborate with us? And he said, yeah, we'll work with you, but there hasn't been any action on that, and they've rejected all of our requests.
Other hot issue this week, the Montgomery County Council seemed to get County Executive Mark Ehrlich a little upset. After unanimously voting down a new contract with the county's main government union, Local 1994 MCGEO, because of disputes over raises for some employees, we got an email from Donna who said, why did the council go against Ehrlich to give the Montgomery County union workers their fair share pay increase? Who on the council voted against this? Were these the council members who usually support the developers in the county, especially District 1? What did you see as the problems with this contract?
It was unanimous, right?
As a compromise, I'll tell you what was... I didn't really have a significant problem with the original contract, and I said that at the time. I just want your listeners to be clear, Kojo. First of all, what's really at issue isn't the whole contract. It's called a makeup step that was offered to the county employees. They deferred their step increase during the recession, as did all county employees and all school system employees, and it's only the county employees who have not received their makeup step. So at this point, many of these people have retired or moved on to other jobs. It only affects about 1 in 10 county workers and only costs us about $1.5 million a year. And that's a very small amount in a $5.7 billion budget. So, you know, look, we have budget challenges. It's not, believe me, because we overpay librarians or nurses or social workers. And if previous councils, before I was there and the last council I served on, we decided to give the makeup step to firefighters and police and teachers and school service employees, how do you deny that then to librarians and social workers and nurses? And second, how do you give it to the majority white, majority male unions like police and fire, and not give it to the majority black, majority women union, McGeo? That doesn't make any sense to me. I didn't have a problem with the original contract. The majority of the council did. We couldn't get them to agree with us. So what we agreed was, as a compromise, rather than allowing the majority to cut the negotiated contract by 25%, it would have been a severe cut, we agreed we would all vote to send it back to the county executive and the union, which we're required to do under the law, let them come back with a counterproposal. Hopeful they will.
Council President Nancy Navarro, who did this and got the compromise and unanimous vote, said that these raises, quote, seemed out of whack with what the county needed to be doing. So,
and also that they are, in her view, unsustainable?
Unsustainable.
Here is, on another issue, Julie in Tacoma Park. Julie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo, thanks. First, I wanted to let everyone know, because they may not, that because of Tom Hucker, our county parks, our playgrounds, actually went pesticide-free. So when the law was being debated by council in 2015 and parks resisted so much, he carved out that space for our kids. So thank you, Tom. But my question is about the story that unfolded last week when the county won the lawsuit about the private laws aspect. So I want to ask Tom what his thoughts are about moving forward, how soon the law will get implemented, and how does the council stop pushback from the very industry that sued to make sure they can't shape the language of the law moving forward?
Council won this pesticide lawsuit.
Yes. The whole county did. I was glad to be one of the co-lead sponsors after George Leventhal put it in originally. a bill to ban the cosmetic use of dangerous lawn pesticides in Montgomery County. And then we were sued by some residents and lawn care companies who wanted to continue to use the pesticides. And we originally lost in circuit court. And very recently, the Court of Special Appeals in Maryland upheld our law. They wrote a very moving decision that began by citing Rachel Carson, who lives in what's now my district, and of course started the modern environmental movement with her focus on pesticides. So, Julie, we are working with the county attorney and the DEP to hopefully implement the law as quickly as possible. And part of it, as you know, I think, wasn't struck down. We've been educating our residents about non-toxic alternatives. You can have a very green lawn and a beautiful home environment without spraying cancer-causing pesticides all over them. And we're spending some of your tax dollars to educate people about what the safe alternatives are.
You, this is the 20th year, people, for Progressive Maryland. You were you among, or you were the person who started Progressive Maryland? Very politically active organization in the state. What's your role? Were you one of the people, or did you do it?
I was.
Did you originate it?
I'm the incorporator. I walked in the state building and filed the papers.
Okay, so
and
people
I was
started.
The only staff person. Yeah, okay. Volunteers.
20 years, Progressive Maryland has been active. What's it done? What role has it played? This is the politics hour. How good has it
been?
That's
funny. I didn't expect to be asked this, but
well, that's
I'm
why
very,
I ask it.
I'm very proud that Progressive Maryland is still around 20 years after I founded it, and I ran it for 6 years. And you know, most nonprofits don't hang in there, especially ones that aren't getting some kind of government funding. And Progressive Maryland has succeeded by getting an awful lot of individual donors from all over the metro area and all over Maryland to support them because they agree with their issues.
Do you think it shifted this time? You've got a Republican governor who's been twice elected now. A lot of people thought Maggie McIntosh would be the best progressive speaker of the three who were running. And you've got a president who's a Republican.
I certainly think they've made a big impact, yeah. I mean, I think there are sort of cultural and policy changes, you know, within the Democratic Party, within progressives, you know, sort of more generally. But I think there's no question that Progressive Maryland, they passed, you know, numerous bills that they took the leadership on that are now county law or state law, like the state's only, you know, we're the only state with a living wage bill that I got to sponsor in Annapolis. They also were early advocates for the Purple Line, which I drive past. It's so fulfilling to see after 20 years of advocacy, seeing that get built every day when I take my kids to school.
Well, we only have about 30 seconds left, but Catherine emails, the county executive has told Animal Services that he wants to move that department out of the police department authority. This makes our officers less safe and less effective. Do you support this move, and if so, why, in 20 seconds?
Oh, well, that's news to me. I think I'd have to learn more about it. I'm not sure. Did she say where he's moving it to, if not under the police?
No, she did not say
okay.
that.
Okay, well, I'm definitely going to look into that, and I'm concerned
Catherine,
about public
Catherine, send
safety.
An email to the council member's
Please
office.
Do.
He'll understand it. Tom Hucker is a member of the Montgomery County Council representing District 5. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Congratulations again on your 20th anniversary.
Thank you. That's it for the show today. In case you missed our local highlights from NPR Music's Tiny Desk Contest, check out the three bands who joined us in studio this week on Instagram at WAMU885. And don't forget to join us back here on Monday. We'll be talking about the local plants and animals at risk of extinction.
And I know you don't want to say this, though I am. I want to point out that even though we were very critical of the mayor on some things today, on Monday, the mayor is going to give you an award for your 20 years as the host of the Kojo Namdi Show. And sincere congratulations.
And thank you very much. And you can bet we'll be celebrating that with ice cream. And you're invited to join us for ice cream. Yes.
Just for real quickly, if folks are wondering what they could do to demand public input into the Beltway process, they could sign the petition to the Board of Public Works at tomhucker.com/beltway.
We're charging for
thank
that.
Thank you.
And that's all we have time for until Monday. Thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Margaret Barthel. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schrobstorf, and our senior producer is Mana Kashvi. Our intern is Sydney Grannon, and our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.